Okay, so here we are reading Savitri by Sri Aurobindo. And today we're going to do a second reading of Book 5, Canto 3, Satyavan and Savitri. And a special treat this week is that Jeffrey, Jen, and Andre are together in Quebec City, so you'll see them on the same video screen. We'll get started with the meditation and then move into the reading.
Book 5, the Book of Love, Canto 3, Satyavan and Savitri. Out of the voiceless mystery of the past, in a present ignorant of forgotten bonds, these spirits met upon the roads of time. Yet in the heart, their secret conscious selves at once aware grew of each other, warned by the first call of a delightful voice and a first vision of the destined face. As when being cries to being from its depths behind the screen of the external sense and strives to find the heart-disclosing word, the passionate speech revealing the soul's need. But the mind's ignorance veils the inner sight. Only a little breaks through our earth-made bounds. So now they met in that momentous hour. So utter the recognition in the deeps, the remembrance lost, the oneness felt and missed. Thus Satyavan spoke to Savitri. O thou who comest to me out of time silences, yet thy voice has wakened my heart to an unknown bliss. Immortal or mortal only in thy frame, for more than earth speaks to me from thy soul, and more than earth surrounds me in thy gaze. How art thou named among the sons of men? Whence hast thou dawned, filling my spirit's days, brighter than summer, brighter than my flowers, into the lonely borders of my life, O sunlight molded like a golden maid? I know that mighty gods are friends of earth. Amid the pageantries of day and dusk, long have I traveled with my pilgrim soul, moved by the marvel of familiar things.
Earth could not hide from me the powers she veils. Even though moving mid an earthly scene and the common surfaces of terrestrial things, my vision saw, unblinded by her forms. The Godhead looked at me from familiar scenes. I witnessed the virgin bridals of the dawn behind the glowing curtains of the sky, or vying in joy with the bright morning's steps, I paced along the slumberous coasts of noon, or the gold desert of the sunlight crossed, traversing great wastes of splendor and of fire, or met the moon gliding amazed through heaven in the uncertain wideness of the night, or the stars marched on their long sentinel routes, pointing their spears through the infinitudes. The day and dusk revealed to me hidden shapes. Figures have come to me from secret shores, and happy faces looked from ray and flame. I have heard strange voices cross the ether's waves. The centaur's wizard song has thrilled my ear. I have glimpsed the apsaras bathing in the pools. I have seen the wood nymphs peering through the leaves. The winds have shown to me their trampling lords. I have beheld the princes of the sun burning in thousand-pillared homes of light. So now my mind could dream and my heart fear that from some wonder couch beyond our air, risen in a wide morning of the gods, thou drovest thy horses from the thunderer's worlds. Although to heaven thy beauty seems allied, much rather would my thoughts rejoice to know that mortal sweetness smiles between thy lids, and thy heart can beat beneath a human gaze, and thy aureate bosom quiver with a look, and its tumult answer to an earth-born voice.
If our time-vexed affections thou canst feel, earth's ease of simple things can satisfy. If thy glance can dwell content on earthly soil, and this celestial summary of delight, thy golden body, dally with fatigue, oppressing with its grace our terrain, while the frail, sweet passing taste of earthly food delays thee, and the torrent's leaping wine descend. Let thy journey cease, come down to us. Close is my father's creepered hermitage, screened by the tall ranks of these silent kings, sung to by voices of the hue-robed choirs, whose chants repeat, transcribed in music's notes the passionate colored lettering of the boughs, and fill the hours with their melodious cry. Amid the welcome hum of many bees, invade our honeyed kingdom of the woods. There, let me lead thee into an opulent life. There, simple is the sylvan hermit life, yet it is clad with the jewelry of earth. Wild winds run, visitors midst the swaying tops, through the calm days, heaven's sentinels of peace, couched on a purple robe of sky above, look down on a rich secrecy and hush, and the chambered nuptial waters chant within. Enormous, whispering, many formed around high forest gods have taken in their arms the human hour, a guest of their centuried pomps. Apparelled are the morns in gold and green, sunlight and shadow tapestry the walls to make a resting chamber fit for thee. A while she paused as if hearing still his voice, unwilling to break the charm, then slowly spoke. Musing, she answered, I am Savitri, princess of Madra. Who art thou? What name musical on earth expresses thee to men?
What trunk of kings watered by fortunate streams has flowered at last upon one happy branch? Why is thy dwelling in the pathless wood, far from the deeds thy glorious youth demands, haunt of the anchorites and earth's wilder broods, where only with thy witless self thou roamest in nature's green unhuman loneliness, surrounded by enormous silences and the blind murmur of primeval calms? And Satyavan replied to Savitri, in days when yet this sight looked clear on life, King Jumatsena once, the Shadowa, reigned through all the tract from which from behind these tops, passing its days of emerald delight, entrusting converse with the traveler winds, turns, looking back towards the southern heavens, and leans its flank upon the musing hills. But equal fate removed her covering hand. A living night enclosed the strong man's paths. Heaven's brilliant gods recalled their careless gifts, took from blank eyes their glad and helping ray, and led the uncertain goddess from his side. Outcast from empire, of the outer light, lost to the comradeship of seeing men, he sojourns in two solitudes, within and in the solemn rustle of the woods. Son of that king, I, Satyavan, have lived contented, for not yet of thee aware, in my high people's loneliness of spirit, and this huge vital murmur kin to me, nursed by the vastness, pupil of solitude. Great nature came to her recovered child. I reigned in a kingdom of a nobler kind than men can build upon dull matter's soil. I met the frankness of the primal earth. I enjoyed the intimacy of infant God.
In the great tapestried chambers of her state, free in her boundless palace I have dwelt, indulged by the warm mother of us all, reared with my natural brothers in her house. I lay in the wide, bare embrace of heaven. The sunlight's radiant blessing clasped my brow. The moonbeam's silver ecstasy at night kissed my dim lids to sleep. Earth's morns were mine. Lured by faint murmurings with the green-robed hours, I wandered lost in woods, prone to the voice of winds and waters, partner of the sun's joy, a listener to the universal speech. My spirit satisfied within me, new godlike our birthright, luxuried our life, whose close belongings are the earth and skies. Before fate led me into this emerald world, aroused by some foreshadowing touch within, an early prescience in my mind approached the great dumb animal consciousness of earth, now grown so close to me, who have left old pomps to live in this grandiose murmur, dim and vast. Already I met her in my spirit's dream. As if to a deeper country of the soul, transposing the vivid imagery of earth through an inner seeing and sense, awakening came. A visioned spell pursued my boyhood's hours. All things the eye had caught in colored lines were seen anew through the interpreting mind, and in the shape it sought to seize the soul. An early child god took my hand, and that held, moved, guided by the seeking of his touch, bright forms and hues which fled across his sight. Limbed upon page and stone, they spoke to men. High beauty's visitants, my intimates were. The neighing pride of rapid life that roams wind-maned through our pastures, on my seeing mood cast shapes of swiftness. Trooping spotted deer against the vesper sky became a song of evening to the silence of my soul.
I caught for some eternal eye the sudden kingfisher flashing to a darkling pool, a slow swan silvering the azure lake, a shape of magic whiteness sailed through dream, leaves trembling with the passion of the wind, pranked butterflies, the conscious flowers of air, and wandering wings in blue infinity, lived on the tablets of my inner sight. Mountains and trees stood there like thoughts from God. The brilliant long bills in their vivid dress, the peacock scattering on the breeze his moons, painted my memory like a frescoed wall. I carved my vision out of wood and stone. I caught the echoes of a word supreme and metered the rhythm beats of infinity and listened through music for the eternal voice. I felt a covert touch. I heard a call, but could not clasp the body of my God or hold between my hands the world mother's feet. In men, I met strange portions of a self that sought for fragments and in fragments lived. Each lived in himself and for himself alone, and with the rest adjoined only fleeting ties. Each passioned over his surface joy and grief, nor saw the eternal in his secret house. I conversed with nature, mused with the changeless stars, God's watch fires burning in the ignorant night, and saw upon her mighty visage fall a ray prophetic of the eternal's sun. I sat with the forest sages in their trance. There poured awakening streams of diamond light. I glimpsed the presence of the one in all, but still there lacked the last transcendent power, and matter still slept empty of its Lord.
The spirit was saved, the body lost and mute, lived still with death and ancient ignorance. The inconscient was its base, the void its fate. But thou hast come, and all will surely change. I shall feel the world mother in thy golden limbs, and hear her wisdom in thy sacred voice. The child of the void shall be reborn in God. My matter shall evade the inconscient's trance. My body, like my spirit, shall be free. It shall escape from death and ignorance. And Savitri, musing still, replied to him, speak more to me, speak more, O Satyavan. Speak of thyself and all thou art within. I would know thee as if we had ever lived together in the chamber of our souls. Speak till a light shall come into my heart, and my moved mortal mind shall understand what all the deathless being in me feels. It knows that thou art he my spirit has sought, amidst earth's thronging visages and forms, across the golden spaces of my life. And Satyavan, replying like a replying harp to the insistent calling of a flute, answered her questioning and let stream to her his heart in many colored waves of speech. O golden princess, perfect Savitri, more I would tell than failing words can speak of all that thou hast meant to me, unknown, all that the lightning flash of love reveals in one great hour of the unveiling gods. Even a brief nearness has reshaped my life, for now I know that all I lived and was moved towards this moment of my heart's rebirth. I look back on the meaning of myself, a soul made ready on earth's soil for thee. Last line. Oh.
Sorry, that was a call coming in. Once were my days like days of other men. To think and act was all, to enjoy and breathe. This was the width and height of mortal hope. Yes, there came glimpses of a deeper self that lives behind life and makes her act its scene. A truth was felt that screened its shape from mind, a greatness working towards a hidden end, and vaguely through the forms of earth there looked something that life is not and yet must be. I groped for the mystery with the lantern, thought. Its glimmerings lighted with the abstract word, a half visible ground, and traveling yard by yard, it mapped a system of the self and God. I could not live the truth it spoke and thought. I turned to seize its form, its invisible things, hoping to fix its rule by mortal mind, imposed a narrow structure of world law upon the freedom of the infinite, a hard, firm skeleton of outward truth, a mental scheme of a mechanic power. This light showed more the darkness unsearched. It made the original secrecy more occult. It could not analyze its cosmic veil or glimpse the wonder worker's hidden hand and trace the pattern of his magic plans. I plunged into an inner seeing mind and knew the secret laws and sorceries that make of matter mind's bewildered slave. The mystery was not solved, but deepened more. I strove to find its hints through beauty and art, but form cannot unveil the indwelling power. Only it draws its symbols at our hearts. It evoked a mood of self, invoked a sign of all the brooding glory hidden in sense. I lived in the ray, but faced out, faced not to the sun.
I looked upon the world and missed the self. And when I found the self, I lost the world. My other selves I lost in the body of God, the link of the finite with the infinite, the bridge between the appearance and the truth, the mystic aim for which the world was made, the human sense of immortality. But now the golden link comes to me with thy feet, and his gold sun has shone on me from thy face. For now another realm draws near with thee, and now diviner voices fill my ear. A strange new world swims to me in thy gaze, approaching like a star from unknown heavens. A cry of spheres comes with thee, and a song of flaming gods. I draw a wealthier breath, and in a fierier march of moments move. My mind transfigures to a rapturous seer. A foam leap traveling from the waves of bliss has changed my heart and changed the earth around. All with thy coming fills. Air, soil, and stream wear bridal raiment to be fit for thee, and sunlight grows a shadow of thy hue because of change within me by thy look. Come nearer to me from thy car of light on this green sward, disdaining not our soil. For here are secret spaces made for thee, whose caves of emerald long to screen thy form. Wilt thou not make this mortal bliss thy sphere? Descend, O happiness, with thy moon-gold feet, enrich earth's floors upon whose sleep we lie. O my bright beauties, Princess Savitri, by my delight and thy own joy compelled, enter my life, thy chamber and thy shrine. In the great quietness where spirits meet, led by my hushed desire into my woods, let the dim rustling arches over thee lean. One with the breath of things eternal live. Thy heart beats near to mine, till there shall leap, enchanted, from the fragrance of the flowers, a moment which all murmurs shall recall, and every bird remember in its cry.
Allured to her lashes by his passionate words, her fathomless soul looked out at him from her eyes. Passing her lips in liquid sounds, it spoke. This word alone she uttered and said all. O Satyavan, I have heard thee and I know. I know that thou and only thou art he. Then down she came from her high carven car, descending with a soft and faltering haste. Her many-hued raiment glistening in the light, hovered a moment over the wind-stirred grass, mixed with a glimmer of her body's ray, like lovely plumage of a settling bird. Her gleaming feet upon the green gold sward, scattered a memory of wandering beams, and lightly pressed the unspoken desire of earth, cherished in her too brief passing by the soil. Then flitting like pale brilliant moths, her hands took from the sylvan verges' sunlit arms a load of their jewel faces' clustering swarms, companions of the springtime and the breeze. A candid garland set with simple forms, her rapid fingers taught a flower song, the stanzaed movement of a marriage hymn. Profound in perfume and immersed in hue, they mixed their yearnings' colored signs and made the bloom of their purity and passion one. A sacrament of joy in treasuring palms she brought, flower symbol of her offered life. Then, with raised hands that trembled a little now, at the very closeness that her soul desired, this bond of sweetness, their bright union's sign, she laid on the bosom coveted by her love.
As if inclined before some gracious God, who has out of his mist of greatness shone, to fill with beauty his adorers' hours, she bowed and touched his feet with worshiping hands. She made her life his world for him to tread, and made her body the room of his delight, her beating heart a remembrancer of bliss. He bent to her and took into his own their married yearning, joined like folded hopes, as if a whole rich world suddenly possessed, wedded to all he had been, became himself an inexhaustible joy made his alone, he gathered all savagery into his clasp. Around her his embrace became the sign of a locked closeness through slow intimate years, a first sweet summary of delight to come, one brevity intense of all long life. In a wide moment of two souls that meet, she felt her being flow into him as in waves a river pours into a mighty sea. As when a soul is merging into God, to live in him forever and know his joy, her consciousness grew aware of him alone, and all her separate self was lost in his. As a starry heaven encircles happy earth, he shut her into himself in a circle of bliss, and shut the world into himself and her. A boundless isolation made them one. He was aware of her enveloping him, and let her penetrate his very soul, as is a world by the world's spirit filled, as the mortal wakes into eternity, as the finite opens to the infinite. Thus were they in each other lost a while. Then drawing back from their long ecstasy trance, came into a new self and a new world.
Each now was a part of the other's unity. The world was but their twin self-finding scene, or their own wedded being's vaster frame. On the high glowing cupola of the day, fair tied a knot with morning's halo threads, while by the ministry of an auspice hour, heartbound before the sun, their marriage fire, the wedding of the eternal Lord and spouse, took place again on earth in human forms. In a new act of the drama of the world, the united two began a greater age. In the silence and murmur of that emerald world, and the mutter of the priest wind's sacred verse, amid the choral whispering of the leaves, love's twain had joined together and grew one. The natural miracle was wrought once more in the immutable ideal world, one human moment was eternal made. Then down the narrow path where their lives had met, he led and showed to her her future world, love's refuge and corner of happy solitude. At the pass end, through a green cleft in the trees, she saw a clustering line of hermit roofs and looked now first on her heart's future home, the thatch that covered the life of Satyavan. Adorned with creepers and red climbing flowers, it seemed a sylvan beauty in her dreams, slumbering with the brown body and tumbled hair in her chamber inviolate with emerald peace. Around it stretched the forest's anchorite mood, lost in the depths of its own solitude. Then moved by the deep joy she could not speak, a little depth of it quivering in her words, her happy voice cried out to Satyavan, "My heart will stay here on this forest verge and close to this thatched roof while I am far. Now of more wondering, it has no need."
"But I must haste back to my father's house, which soon will lose one loved accustomed tread, and listen in vain for a once cherished voice. For soon I shall return, nor ever again oneness must sever its recovered bliss, or fate sunder our lives while life is ours." Once more she mounted on the carven car, and under the ardor of a fiery noon, less bright than the splendor of her thoughts and dreams, she sped swift-reined, swift-hearted, but still saw in still lucidities of sight's inner world, through the cool-scented woods' luxurious gloom, on shadowy paths between great rugged trunks, pace towards a tranquil clearing, Satyavan. A nave of trees enshrined the hermit thatch, the new deep covert of her felicity, preferred to heaven, her soul's temple and home. This now remained with her, her heart's constant scene. End of Canto 3, end of Book 5.
Any responses? Reflections?
Well, Mateo pointed out one time when we were reading this not too long ago that this is actually their marriage. So that I was just kind of assuming that they, once she came back to the forest hermitage after telling her father, that there would be a marriage ceremony. But there's already a marriage ceremony here, and the visitors and the guests and the presiding powers are the forces of nature, the sun and the winds and the day and the flowers.
Th- That was something that I noticed more or picked up on more than the first time that we read this. And it's very, it's right there. They say it's marriage. But everything is, there's so much poetic floweriness happening and so much high discourse in this court. There's a courtship as well, I think, right? That the scene is the forest and she's on a carven car. So I'm imagining one of these royal types of carriages. And then she has reins, so there must be horses there. And she's up. He's down here on the ground, but she's up in this car. And in his speech, he's inviting or imploring her to descend. He uses that word a few times, descend. Sometimes it comes at the end of a long sentence in the lines. But then on page 409, there is that scene where she, in essence, assents to his invitations. She says, "O Satyavana, I have heard thee and I know. I know that thou and only thou art he." And a little further down, the poem says, "A candid garland set with simple forms, her rapid fingers taught a flower song, the stanzied movement of a marriage hymn. A candid garland set with simple forms, her rapid fingers taught a flower song, the stanzied movement of a marriage hymn." I imagine her picking flowers and making them into a kind of ceremony, a garland, or that is the song that is accompanying their union. And then there's a sacrament of joy in treasuring palms she brought, flower symbol of her offered life. Then with raised hands that trembled a little now at the very closeness that her soul desired, this bond of sweetness, their bright union's sign, she laid on the bosom coveted by her love. So she has like this garland of flowers that's like a symbolic kind of offering of her soul to his. And she puts it down on the bosom coveted. Would that be his chest or?
Yeah.
So he's maybe standing and she puts it over him or something like that. Right, all that, and then a few lines later on 410, their married yearning joined like folded hopes, as if a whole rich world suddenly possessed, wedded to all he had been, became himself, an inexhaustible joy made his alone, he gathered all savagery into his clasp. So there's like this embrace. I mean, it's so, I keep making this motion above my head because it feels like it all is just kind of like floating above the earth by a couple of feet. I think somebody asked Shunryu Suzuki, you know, what's the difference between being enlightened, if every being has Buddha mind, what's the difference between being enlightened and being not enlightened? And he said, well, they're the same. It's just enlightened is like floating 2 feet above the ground. So that's the feeling I get here. This is how wonderful that Andre and Jeffrey Jenner are together too. The timing is quite spectacular.
I noticed these are not white people because there's a reference to a brown body, and I took a workshop recently given by an organization called Writing the Other, which talks about writing for diversity, human diversity, but also diverse cultures. And it was pointed out that white writers don't mention the color of the characters, but black writers do, because it matters, right? So it's a kind of a nasty habit that white people just assume that everybody's like them, so they don't have to mention the color of the person. Of course, Sri Aurobindo wasn't white. I think it's interesting that he actually put that into the story, that, remind us that this isn't necessarily a story about white people.
That's a good point. I think back to maybe in some older poetry I've read, there can be more of a maybe pre-racialized or racial kind of self-aware discourse, that there is the figure of the white goddess. There are certain kind of figures that are painted as white. But they often come with the moral, sort of the moral connotation, white being pure, being divine, or being heavenly or celestial, and black also often has, or at least had, in sort of pre-reflective discourse, the evil, the connotation with evil or negativity, or darkness, and I think that's something that we've inherited, and obviously I've been working on deconstructing for many decades now, but it's very sort of insipid, the associations that our minds make with colors and skin colors particularly. And, you know, what writers of color who identify as being writers of color, you know, have to do to can create or gain recognition for their own experience. So I didn't even note that, but it's true that it is there. And in your own work, Jeffrey, Jen, you also, I think, bring some in Plenum, for example. The novel that we're at the tail end of editing and moving towards publishing, Shosie, one of the characters, if I'm not mistaken, you describe her as being brown bodied. I don't recall what the Kinch, like what they, or some, maybe it was a couple of the Kinch Kinlas, the kind of older mentor figures, who were also brown-bodied, but I noticed that you brought some attention to that, so that we weren't just subconsciously assuming that these were all, you know, white-skinned or not even white. They don't exactly have skin the way that we have skin. I mean, they do, but they have these other sort of technological layers. But then, in real life, Mira Alfasa was a French woman, so she was a white woman too, meeting Savitri. So it was also a union across those those racial differences, or certainly cultural differences, ethnic differences.
So she was actually Middle Eastern. Her mother is from Egypt. Her father is from Turkey. So she's not a Western white woman. She is a kind of the in between, the, you know, Arab, Jewish background, genetic background.
Oh, that's interesting. It is tricky because within non-Western cultures, there's still, even if they would be from the perspective of a Western civil society, like in the US or Europe, they would be considered ethnic an ethnic minority, perhaps. But then within their own context, there are still divisions between darker skinned and lighter skinned people. Brazil is, I think, like this as well. And their own kind of caste or hierarchies, but often following the same gradation, you know, where whiter is more associated with well-to-do, affluent, educated, and so on, and the opposite for darker colored skin. And I, you know, we did the census in the United States. Every 10 years, there's a census, and part of it is to collect demographic information about the population. But it's a very kind of weird and convoluted set of decisions that one has to make, because you could identify, for example, as Hispanic, which has its own kind of set of things, because Hispanic is associated with Spain. Latino, or Latinx, as the newer kind of language is kind of trying to bring forward, is more associated with South America and the kind of post-cult, you know, the colonized rather than the colonizers. But then the question, you could be Hispanic or Latino and be white, or they don't give you the option of brown in the census. Or it's very complicated and convoluted, but it is the kind of thing that I think we're bringing, writers especially, you know, are bringing and have to bring a lot more attention to these days. But it's also, you know, in a way, it's historically contingent. It's kind of the way that history unfolded and who won and who lost and who conquered and who was conquered. And I think we have to work through it. And it's just part of the messy work that people have to do to resolve the past and to sort of put certain conflicts, you know, to process certain conflicts. But there's so much more going on in the poem too, you know, beyond the particularities of the identities, because there's also this sense here that it's not just two humans meeting each other, but there's also a kind of archetypal marriage of earth and heaven, earth and sky, or nature and spirit, with Satyavan embodying and representing and embodying the spiritual, the transcendental, the infinite, and Savitri embodying like the natural and the earth, and them coming together in this union where she flows into him and he encompasses her and she permeates him, and he provides her with a home, like a haven. And then this way that they get lost in each other, and they become their own, like isolate, their own rupture in a way with the world as such, which remains clouded in ignorance and in history. And that way in which the mortal becomes immortal, or the mortal that one can experience freedom or spirit, not just in the spiritual, but in the flesh, in the body, that's the kind of next step here, which came really, really early, page 406, where Satyavan is describing kind of the situation or the predicament he was in. The spirit was saved, but the body lost and mute, lived still with death and ancient ignorance. The inconscient was its base, the void its fate. But thou hast come and all will surely change. I shall feel the world mother in thy golden limbs and hear her wisdom in thy sacred voice. The child of the void shall be reborn in God. My matter shall evade the inconscient's trance. My body, like my spirit, shall be free. It shall escape from death and ignorance. That's, I think, the hard, that's a hard step. We can imagine freedom in the infinite. I think it's much harder to imagine freedom in the finite.
So Savitri is actually an incarnation of the daughter of the sun. She's an incarnation of the Divine Mother. And Satyavan represents the human being who is in touch with this higher realm, and he gets that especially in nature. And then when she comes, she brings her divine self to him. And this is where this union, you know, between heaven and earth really becomes realized for humanity.
Are you saying it's flipped?
Yeah.
From what I described?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, he lives, of course, in a transcendent world, but he's very much in nature. But he represents the human being. He represents the soul of the human being. And she is an incarnation of the Divine Mother that Ashwapati begged the Divine Mother to come down to earth. And she agreed. And she gave him a daughter that was her daughter, or an emanation of herself.
Okay.
And it's because she is here and she's finding the human being, Satyavan, that this merger can take place in consciousness and in the body. Yeah.
So we often associate the mother with the earth, like Mother Earth.
Yeah.
Would you say that this is kind of a bit different than that? It's mother is more cosmic.
Well, he's also Mother Earth because she created the earth, but she is a divine mother.
Okay. I'll sit with that.
It's pretty a little bit astonishing to me that they consummate their marriage on the spot. They're like, wow, well, they know it's right? They recognize each other, and they get married right then and there. Wow.
Yeah, that takes a leap of certain of faith or recognition. But it seems so overwhelmingly obvious, and this is also a kind of symbolic or a ritual marriage. Like, they're probably not going to go out and buy a house with a mortgage and have a kid go through the hall.
They're going to live in the hut with his father, according to Indian tradition. The son stays home and the daughter moves in with the son's family. And that's what they do. Yeah.
And he's a prince. He's the son of a king, but he's in a forsaken his kingdom, as it were.
Because the father got blind and he couldn't rule anymore. So he withdrew.
But his new opulence is the forest itself, like the jewelry of the earth.
It's gorgeous.
He calls it.
Yeah.
There's so many great, beautiful lines in this canto,
starting from the opening lines, which I also love for this canto. Could put you right in the mood, as it were.
Yeah, he's good at that.
Out of the voiceless mystery of the past, in a present ignorant of forgotten bonds, these spirits met upon the roads of time. Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, those forgotten bonds are interesting to...
Right. We don't remember our past lives when we knew each other.
Yeah.
But we recognize one another, right?
Promises we made in past lives, it seems.
and the roads of time is always very evocative too. So we often hear the term on the roads, but it's rarely we hear roads of time. It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love the pranked butterflies. I don't know, if maybe we mentioned this last time, Andre, when it was you and me, but the conscious flowers of air and wandering wings in blue infinity. And then holding between my hands the world mother's feet. That's a beautiful image as well.
I had never noticed before reading this canto that Satyavan talked about before his father was exiled from his kingdom, when he lived in the city, that he already had the vision of this earth, this earth realm that he didn't know externally, but he already had the vision of it in his dreams. It's like when the exiles happened and he actually came into the forest, it was kind of a fulfillment of that, or an enrichment of those dreams that he had before that break happened.
And I think there was a sense, I don't know where it is, that he also knew of her, that she would come.
It was a...
Yeah.
There's also a statement here, which I think says something about maybe Aurobindo's view on the limits of art. It's 407, toward the bottom, where Satyavan is, I guess, recounting his path to this moment, to this meeting. And he's talking about thought, and when the mode of thinking and acting, to think and act was all, to enjoy and breathe. This was a kind of self-sense that he's coming out of, groping for the mystery with the lantern thought. And then he says, I strove to find, he's speaking of the self, spirit, but form, I strove to find its hints through beauty and art, but form cannot unveil the indwelling power. Only it throws its symbols at our hearts. It evoked a mood of self, invoked a sign of all the brooding glory hidden in sense. I lived in the ray, but faced not to the sun. I looked upon the world and missed the self. And when I found the self, I lost the world. And it goes on, but there's this moment there where one thinks, okay, as an artist and writer, I've been heavily invested in these forms that, you know, that we create, whether they're poetic forms or literary forms, or but I think it's good to be reminded that they're still forms of something, and the thing of which they are the forms is not reducible to the forms, that, you know, one can become overly transfixed by or enmeshed with forms, or this mood of self, these signs and symbols, which they are direct to, or they are about, they refer to the infinite, and they can create the like maybe a bridge to the infinite or an opening to it, but are not this thing itself, right? They're not the they're not the ultimate. I think that's an interesting one that I'm going to think about a bit more. Because then again, here we are in the epic poem, Savitri. This is all being embodied and encapsulated in this work. So perhaps Aurobindo was pushing the limits of you know, what art could do and what it can point, how it can point to the greater reality.
Has another, he has a short poem called In Horis Aeternum. In Horis Aeternum. Eternally in the hours. And at the end of that poem, he says, a nothing that was all and is found. A nothing that was all and is found. And the nothings are these symbols that you're talking about. And he says, that was all. So I don't think I would stand on this line that you read here, form cannot unveil the undwelling power, as if that's the only thing possible. Because Sri Aurobindo, he's using language, and he also uses language in this other way to say a nothing. And what are the nothings? You know, a smile or a bird song, or and that nothing in the hours is all, and it can be found. The all can be found there.
So I had a discussion this morning in another meeting about, we were talking about writing scientific articles versus writing fiction and or art in general. And, because science writing tends to be focused on the denotative, and the artist is not interested so much in the strict descriptions of things, but the vocations they generate. So, and it was, mentioned that it's not, so in a way it's not, I mean, art is only about only forms. And I mean, that's certainly one way that you could look at art, but the art is not in the forms, but in the spaces between the forms, or in the things that are generated out of the forms, right? So, I think there is a room there for deeper issues, right, than just the form.
And form itself, which is a concept. Form is a concept. We take the flow of our experience and we freeze it a bit so we can say this is a form. And when we freeze it and think that's the real, we're actually pointing to something we've frozen as the real. And that can be real also, since the Indian view is all is he, all is that. But it's also more than itself. It's more than the frozen shape.
I think those points are well taken. I like the more than, and I like the spaces in between, and I mean, if we think about this frozen shape of a poem, these words on a page in a certain form, these squiggly black lines, that is that where the poem is? Is the meaning of the poem or the being of the poem in the lines, in the physical form of it? Well, there's also a subtle form. There's also like the meanings of the words mentally that are cultural, that are in the language, and then we each have within us as participants in the language, as speakers of the language. But then there's also what's maybe not just the form of the poem, but the action of the poem. Like, what is it evoking? What is it awakening one to? And this seems like where the poem is not just about itself. It's about that opening, you know, where something else, the spirit, let's say, can become apparent. This is very, very interesting. I think about this a lot, you know, because, you know, when one invests in a form, like, when one has to invest a certain amount if you're going to create it, otherwise it just won't come into being without caring enough about the form. But if that is all that the form is about, then one might be missing the point. Like, I once somebody gave me my brother actually gave me, it was kind of a joke, but I took kind of a deeper grain of truth to it. A pin that he bought in Brooklyn said, "Your poem doesn't matter," or something like that. And it was kind of like like Brooklyn, there are a lot of the people that, you know, others call hipsters, who would, you know, have a certain kind of character of, maybe you could say, just caring more about the form of things than about the meaning or the truth of things, like the appearance, the pose, you know, and how annoying that is, you know, to just a regular, you know, to the general population, just general people who, you know, are not as entranced with the form, with the floweriness of the language, or the sophistication of the verse, or what have you, but are, you know, like, what does it actually, just get to the point. What does it mean? And there is, I mean, I'm obviously sympathetic to the form of things. But there was a point to that too, which I think that part of what art is too, is a sacrifice. Like, one is putting more into the form than actually can fit in form. And so in a way, the form has to kind of like exhaust itself. Like, it has to be filled so that it can be emptied, if that makes sense. These are the edges of thought to which Savitri brings us. So I may not be able to go much further than that.
Sometimes I think of Savitri as page after page after page filled with koans over and over and over with the opposites jammed together in this most beautiful way to blow your mind.
Usually you get one koan to work with and you have to,
I know,
you have to sit with it for, you know, long months, years. Here's 10,000 koans.
It's a blizzard of koans.
That probably has its own way of breaking the habits and the patterns of the mind. It definitely does. Okay. Next time we would move on to book five. Book six, the Book of Fate. Which I'm not sure if that's 2 weeks from now. Are we on the second Wednesday already?
No, this is the first Wednesday. Yeah. So the third Wednesday.
Okay. A little bit lost on the roads of time. Well, shall we meditate a bit and then close the meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, friends, for this reading.
Thank you.
Weeks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, enjoy your time.
Yes.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.